We've come in our study of Romans 8 down to verse 36, where the basic thesis of this verse in its context is Paul's statement in verse 31 that we should conclude certain things about the things that he declared, particularly in verses 26 through 30. And there are basically two issues that we've been looking at. The one is God is for us. That's what we should conclude. But we should also think about our adversary or adversaries, because he says, God is for us, who can be against us? And he spent verse 32 talking about how God is for us. And his argument was that he spared not his only son, delivered him up for us all, and will freely give us all the necessary things that are required in order for us to be able to walk in this life that he's granted us. And then in verses 33 all the way down to verse 39, the question then is the against us notions, which strongly implies that we buy fairly quickly into the idea that God sent his son for us and he's willing to give us what we need to live in the life that he's granted. But we do struggle with this issue of just how much he is for us when we have all of this stuff against us. And it starts out with the charge that is leveled against God's elect in verse 33. And then in verse 34, the one who would condemn us. And even the issue of verse 34, where Christ is on the right hand of the Father interceding for us, has its own set of difficulties for our thinking. I was wondering on the way over here this evening how the intercession of the ministry of the Spirit, verse 26, and the intercession of the Son on the right hand of God, how does that work with the Laodicean church in Revelation 3? So there are issues that Paul doesn't come right out and deal with, but he does declare that the Spirit and the Son are both interceding for us. And then he raised the issue of verse 35, about somebody might be able to separate us from the love of God or the love of Christ. And then he raises all these various ways that we might be separated: tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword. And we talked about how all of those issues really boil down to whether those particulars can be used by the adversary in his arguments in our own head about how confident that we are that God is for us. Because if we believe he's for us, then these things don't really have much weight. I mean, you can put up with tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword, as long as you understand that somehow or another those all fit into Romans 8:28. They don't mitigate the fact that God is for us. But we do have to understand, and that raises the issue of verse 36, which is, I think, one of the oddest quotes that I've run across in recent months studying in Romans, because he says, just as it is written. In other words, here's the proof that we can't be separated from the love of Christ. For your sake, we are being put to death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. That doesn't sound very encouraging. It sounds like, wait a minute, Paul, what are you doing here? So, we're going to spend our time this evening primarily in Psalm 44, because this is a quote right out of Psalm 44, verse 22. But it seems to be SOP, the standard operating procedure for believers, to be confused and downcast when our circumstances go south, and God seems to be relatively, if not completely, silent. And Paul knew this, and he decided to confront this response by believers with the 180-degree opposite truth, that rather than being downcast and confused, we ought to be upbeat. Verse 37 says, in all these things we are more than conquerors, or we are more than mere conquerors through him who loved us. There should be this upbeat reality, and we should be emboldened by this mixture of difficult circumstances and silence from God. And yet that's not the typical reaction to the normal Christian. it's almost always the case, and I've thought this for a long, long time, especially since years and years and years ago, a promoter of a false cult handed me a book. It was called The Make Sure Book, and it was a perversion of the quote from Paul's statement to make sure of all things, hold fast to that, which is fine. And every doctrinal thesis that Christians put their trust in, this book quoted texts out of context that seemed to contradict those conclusions and put forward an alternative conclusion. And the doctrine was completely non-Christian. But they were using the Bible, verse by verse, quoting verses out of context. They were just listed in the list. And that's the danger, of course, of reading a book like that, because you can marshal quotes and confuse people pretty fast. It did me. Until I began to realize that you cannot use the truth in service of a lie. Which means that if somebody's quoting a verse to support a lie, the truth is probably supporting the truth, and therefore it would deny the lie if we understood the truth. So, it's my contention that it's almost always the case. In fact, I'd say it's always the case that a lie is a presentation of something that is the complete opposite of the truth. And Paul, I think, deliberately selected Psalm 44:22, "For your sake we're being put to death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered," to make his case regarding whether we can be separated from the love of Christ and whether or not, in fact, we are conquerors rather than defeated people. Because Psalm 44:22 seems to make his case. It highlights the very reality that he's dealing with in this setting. Rather than being evidence that God doesn't love us, which is the way most people, even a lot of Christians, do use, they think that if they're being badly treated, it's proof that he doesn't care about them, and therefore they deny his love for them. And Paul is arguing that, in fact, the opposite is true, that being badly treated proves his love for us. But that's a stretch for most people to really buy into. In fact, we heard this week about a young man who is doubting the fact that God loves him in spite of being raised in a Christian home and all of that, because none of the arguments appeal to him mentally, and so he just dismisses them. It doesn't matter if they're true or not. He doesn't feel loved, or his circumstances in life don't reveal love from God, so he's convinced that God doesn't love him. Well, he's wrong, but this is what Paul is doing. He's deliberately choosing one of the oddest psalms in the Psaltery, as far as I'm concerned, and I haven't studied all of them, so I'm not really qualified to say that, but I said it anyway. We're going to look at this quote from Psalm 44 in the context of Paul's argument that this is just as it stands written. In other words, this is the proof that you can't be separated from the love of God that's in Christ. God is for us. And so that brings us to the issue of Psalm 44. So let's go backwards in our Bibles to Psalm 44 and look at the verse in its context, because I think it's very appropriate in light of a lot of the mushy thinking that goes on about God, especially in light of the question of whether he really cares or if this is just a doctrinal set of propositional truths that don't really hang together. In Psalm 44, if you were to read down through the first 8 verses quickly, what you would find is that it's a record of the psalmist saying, "We've heard about the history of your work in the past from our forefathers. They've told us all about how you did things in their day and how you drove the nations out of the land of Canaan in their day and how they benefited from all of the good that you did for them and how you spread them abroad and so on." And he even says in verse 3 that by their own sword they did not possess the land, and their own arm did not save them, but by your right hand and your arm and the light of your presence, you favored them. You showed grace to them. And so he says, you're my God, you're my king. I pray that you'll command victories for Jacob. And through you, we'll push back and our adversaries will be defeated. And in your name, we'll trample them down. And I'll not trust in my bow or my sword to save me, but I'll trust in God. And he uses this phrase in verse 8. In God we have boasted all day long. Well, that all day long thing comes up again in verse 22. For your sake we're killed all day long. And so he starts out the psalm by talking about how it's not the same. We've heard from our fathers about all of this stuff you did. And I'm going to stake my claim to the stuff on what I've heard from them. And I'll boast in you all the day long because you're going to trample down our enemies and so forth. And we're not going to trust in our bow or sword. We're going to trust in you. But when you turn to verse 9 through 16, he says, you've rejected us. You've brought us dishonor. You don't go out before our armies, and you cause us to turn back from the adversaries, and those who hate us have taken spoil for themselves. You've given us as sheep to be eaten and have scattered us among the nations, and you sell your people cheaply and have not profited from their sale. You make us a reproach to our neighbor, scoffing and a derision to those who are around us. You make us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock. All day long, here's that phrase again, my dishonor is before me and my humiliation has overwhelmed me because of the voice of him who reproaches and reviles because of the presence of the enemy and the adversary. And so in verses 9 through 16, he actually, in effect, says, it's not working like it did. Our fathers have told us that when they trusted in you and didn't depend on their sword or whatever, you defeated their adversaries, but you're not doing that now. And then he makes it worse. In verses 17 through 19, or actually verse 21, he says, all this has come upon us, but we haven't forgotten you. We have not dwelt falsely with your covenant. Our heart has not turned back. Our steps have not deviated from your way. Yet you've crushed us in a place of jackals and covered us with the shadow of death. If we'd forgotten the name of our God or extended our hands to a strange God, would not God find this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart. In other words, we don't deserve to be treated like this. He said in the beginning that he believed that God had done this graciously for them. But now that it's his turn to be dealt with, grace is out of the picture now, and it's about what we've done and haven't done, and what we don't deserve to be treated this way because we haven't forgotten about you, and And then he says in verse 22, for your sake we're killed all day long, we're considered as sheep to be slaughtered. And then in verse 23 and following, he says, arouse yourself, why do you sleep? This sounds like something you've heard about. Awake, Lord, don't you know we're going to drown? And he says, awake, don't reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our opposition? Our soul has sunk down into the dust and our body cleaves to the earth. Rise up, be our help and redeem us for the sake of your loving kindness. When you go through this psalm like this, what we see is that there's a record of the distant past and a historically accurate record of God's obvious involvement in a gracious way to set his people up in a special place and run their adversaries off. And it focuses on the activity of God as an expression of his grace and initiative. And it leads to a determination to depend on God to save us from our enemies, but the outcome of it is that's not what's happening. He immediately goes into the litany of complaints. One thing after another, you've done this, you've done this, this is happening to us, this is happening to us, this is happening to us, this is happening to us. And there is complete confusion and shame of face. Because God did not and is not acting as we expected from what our forefathers told us. I have an idea that their forefathers set them up for the modern day preaching that Jesus Christ is the same today, yesterday, today, and forever. That means whatever he did back then, he'll still do today and forever. that's on the face of it ludicrous, but it is very deceitful, and it makes it possible for you to say, well, if Jesus ever did this, then he'll do it today too. And of course, that's the prosperity thing and the healing thing and all of that kind of stuff, where if you can find a place where Jesus did it and he's the same yesterday, today, and forever, then if you need it, he'll do it today. And then in the future, if it's necessary, he'll do it again. That's just not true. This psalm admits that that's not true. That God behaved a certain way back then, but he's not behaving that way now. And then there is this deeper complaint, particularly in verses 17 through 21, where the psalmist, in his disintegration of situation, has allowed himself to forget the whole issue of the grace of God and the fact of his initiative and what he is attempting to do, and whether or not that suits his children. Because we don't deserve this, is basically what the psalmist is saying. And it's almost an immediate forgetfulness of the realization of verse 3. You favored them. You gave them grace. It wasn't their arms. It wasn't their swords. You did this. So, I think the outstanding problem is, in verses 22 through 26, that the psalm recognizes two things. One of them is that refrain, all the day long. He said in verse 6 that he would, or verse 8, that he would boast in God all the day long. And then, wherever that other reference was that I pointed out, all the day long. And then in verse 22, for your sake we're killed all the day long. There's this all the day long phrase. And then there is another issue, and that is the statement that he makes when he says, for your sake. For your sake, verse 22 says, we are killed all day long. For your sake. And that fundamentally, with a human heart that's not been purged of its selfishness, that's the problem. We like a God who will treat us graciously, as long as gracious treatment always means that we'll get not what we deserve but what we want, because he's gracious and he'll be good to us, kind and gentle and overwhelming with blessing and all that kind of thing. And he forgets that there is this for your sake business. And I think that in circumstances like this, we run into the same kind of thing that Mark 4:38 had when the disciples were on the sea and the boat was going to be filled up and they were going to drown, they thought. It's almost like the disciples have forgotten that Jesus has plans and purposes for the stuff that he's doing, and it's by his grace and his initiative and in the hiddenness of what he's pursuing. And there are two outstanding Old Testament examples. The one is the book of Job. And in my understanding of the book of Job, I think the book of Job was the foundation for Paul's statement that now abides faith, hope, and love, these three, but the greatest of these is love. Faith was the Proverbs, and hope was Ecclesiastes, and love was Job. And the real issue in Job is whether God's is worthy of our love, even when nothing is going right. That's really the issue in the book of Job. And Job goes a long way down the trail of blaming God for mistreating him, because he was surrounded by not only his own innate selfishness, but his whole culture, because his friends are all legalists, and they're all telling him, you've got to have done something bad, or God wouldn't be treating you this way. And they have no clue. They didn't know chapter 1 and 2. Job didn't at the beginning. He didn't know that God had a reason for Job's experience that was bigger than Job. And it didn't mean that God didn't love him. It meant that he did. And that he wanted to prove to the adversaries that Job loved him back. And that was the challenge. The only reason he loves you is because you treat him so good. And God says, that's not true. Yeah, it is. No, I didn't. You can do whatever you want, but you can't kill him. And that's when everything went south, was when Satan was given the freedom to treat Job badly. For God's sake, he was treated badly, day after day, all the day long. And yet, James says that in our times of trial, we need to remember Job. Remember the patience of Job. So Job becomes the classic illustration of a man living in ignorance of what God's got in mind and what's going on in the heavenlies, and he's struggling to hold on to his loyalty to God, but he's rooting his attitude toward God in terms of, well, if you really love me, you wouldn't be letting this happen to me. And then finally God has to confront him, and Job says, I shut my mouth. I didn't know. Well, that's true. You didn't know. But there's never going to be a time when you will know everything, so you might as well get used to the fact there are going to be lots of things you didn't know. That's why you're supposed to trust me when I say stuff. That's what God's thing is. So on the one hand, you have Job. And then on the other hand, you have that well-known fellow named Joseph, whose descent into being poorly treated started in his own household and degenerated from there. Everywhere he went, somebody dealt him dirt, and he ended up deeper in the pile, so that he finally was in prison because his master's wife accused him of trying to sexually assault her, and the reason she accused him is because he refused to sexually get involved with her. You can't think of something more unjust or unfair of a vindictive woman. The record is the same in both cases for Joseph and for Job, and that is the outcome is the longer term evidence of what the real truth is. And so we have to be careful that we don't make our decisions too soon about whether or not our circumstances are an argument for or against the love of God. So that's the background in Psalm 44. We have a psalmist who is in the midst of a very legal setting in the life of humanity. He's a participant in the fallenness of Adam, and he is a knee-jerk, because we all are, legalist, in the sense that we all have this desire to be able to control how well we're treated by God by doing the things that he tells us to do. We all got that. I don't want to be punished by God, so I'm going to do what he tells me. Well, you do what he tells you, and you'll be in big trouble anyway. All you got to do is read the New Testament. The people who did what God wanted them to do ended up being abused and persecuted and famine and sword and so on. So what's Paul's real argument in Romans 8? What's he saying? Well, let's go back to Romans 8 and look at what the words that he uses to express his argument. He says, it stands written. And he says that in light of the claim that bad things like tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword can't separate us from the love of Christ. He says, in the face of that, it stands written, and it's just like it stands written. In other words, his argument is, these things can't separate you from the love of God because it's a biblical principle. It stands written that this bad treatment doesn't separate us from the love of Christ. So he starts it off by talking about the fact that we have this written standard, and the psalmist basically was misusing it to start with, because his use of God's activity in the distant past, he thought, should be the norm for all time, and it's never been that way. There have been times when the activity of God became a norm for a certain period of time, but it never stayed the same. When Jesus came on the scene, he told his disciples, after I'm gone, you need to go buy a sword, because they're going to mistreat you and persecute you, and even members of your own family will betray you, and they'll try to kill you, and it's going to be a bad scene. And that's not the norm that everybody wants to live in. But Jesus said, this is the way it's going to be now. Back in the days when God's plan was to set the people in the land, it was God's business to run the inhabitants of that land out of that land so that he could establish his people in it. That was his plan. And for his sake, he did those things to those nations and ran them out. Well, now, Jesus actually says that anybody that suffers whatever for my sake and the gospel's will reap benefit down the road. So it's still in relation to his sake. And it still has to do with being badly treated. So that's part of the issue. It's always been in God's plan that the actual norm is that his people will be badly treated by those who have no faith, and he wouldn't deliver them most of the time. Sometimes he would, but he didn't do it for Paul. He didn't do it for Jesus. He told his disciples he wouldn't do it for them. He is not going to always deliver. It's even odd, if you want to look at it this way, that God allowed the persecution in Jerusalem to kill James, and they had already stoned Stephen to death, and then they arrested Peter. And what did the church do? They got together to pray for Peter. And they were praying that God had delivered, and they're praying. And so when God delivered them, they didn't even believe it. Knocks on the door, and the little gal says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm Peter." He says, "You can't be Peter. You're in prison." And they praying that God delivered them. They didn't expect it. It wasn't the norm. And sometimes God does do some special things, but it's not the norm. And so I think that one of the things we have to realize that Paul's argument here is, it's the norm in this world to be badly treated if you believe the truth. And there have been cycles in history, and I think, for example, the United States, at least in my lifetime, for the most part, you weren't going to be badly treated in this world, in this part of this world, by living according to your Christian convictions. For the most part. Now, you would be if those Christian convictions got your boss in a bind. Then you'd suffer because your boss was going to try to force you to not put him in a bind because of your conscience. That kind of thing. But generally speaking, you could live your Christian life and do the righteous and godly things and basically be fine. That's an aberration in the norm. It's an aberration in the norm of the world. While people in the United States were being treated like that, people everywhere else were being put to death for the name of Jesus. It just happened to be a geographical aberration for a certain period of time, and nobody knows how long that will benefit us. But the fact is, it stands written. This is the norm. Psalm 44:22 really is the overarching norm. That for God's sake, for the sake of his plans and his purposes, we're being put to death all day long. We're considered as sheep to be slaughtered. It stands written. And then that issue of for thy sake. Because God's plan includes a most fundamental element regarding the qualifications of those who will participate in his kingdom. And that bottom line issue for participation in his kingdom is the total elimination of selfishness on our part and a contradictory alternative of embedding a powerful determination in us to be willing to suffer for the sake of others. Now, granted, we never get there in this world, in this life, in terms of total issues. There is nobody who is totally selfless. There are many who are totally selfish. But the issue of being moved into the direction of being qualified for participation in the kingdom is the issue of whether or not we've been willing to sacrifice for the sake of others. Because if you want to be great in the kingdom, you've got to learn to be a servant. Learning to be a servant means doing things for other people that might cost you something, but it'll benefit them. That's the whole essence of the kingdom of the Christ. It's a kingdom of servants. So, in a very real sense, a lot of the stuff that we're put through, a lot of the negative stuff that we're put through it because it challenges our selfishness, and it's good for us to be challenged in those ways. It's not pleasant, but it's good for us. So God's plan is to wean us from our self-focus and put our focus on someone else. And in this case, the someone else is for your sake. And he's already shown that he wouldn't spare his son for our sake. So what right do we have to spare anybody of our or anything of ours for his sake? We don't dare hang on to the stuff that would keep us from being a reciprocating lover. He loved us to this degree. We're supposed to be learning to love him to the same degree. And, of course, the degree is enormous. So, he's just telling us, this is the process. Being subjected to death all day long, Paul said to the Corinthians, teaches us to depend on God and not ourselves. Well, that's where we're supposed to be. And according to Jesus' own teaching to his disciples, that there will be times when they will be subjected to these kind of persecutions and afflictions, and he is not going to deliver them. He didn't deliver Stephen because he had a reason for not delivering him. He didn't deliver James because he had a reason for not delivering him. He did deliver Peter because he had a reason for delivering him. But he didn't save Paul from having to spend, what, two or three nights in the deep and being beaten with stripes three times and being thrown in jail and being persecuted and all the time. The whole issue is that the kingdom of God is a kingdom where people are willing to pay whatever price for somebody else's sake, and that's what we're supposed to be learning. So, there are very few things that are more illuminating than being faced with horrifying circumstances that indicate the nature of a false love, where we are pushed by our circumstances to recognize that we've got our fists tightly gripped around something that we're not supposed to have a grip on at all. That's why Jesus said, you can't love anybody more than me, or you're not worthy of me. And he wasn't saying that because he's an egomaniac. He was just saying, look, you got to get your priorities straight. And one of the issues of priorities is your loves. Who do you love most? And that's the bottom line. We get challenged by the things that God, for his sake, subjects us to or allows us to be subjected to. And we're not supposed to be great complaint about that thing. He doesn't love me. He's not for me. He doesn't care about me. Because the alternative in verse 37 is the strongest adversative. But instead of concluding from, we're being put to death all day long, we're considered as sheep to be slaughtered, see, that proves that God isn't for us. He says, no, it does not prove that. Verse 37, but in all these things, we are more than mere conquerors. I translate that mere conquerors because the idea of being a victor or a conqueror is one thing, but the word that he uses implies that you're, the translators go with overwhelmingly conquer. We overwhelmingly conquer. But the real issue here is we are not defeated by these negative circumstances. Period. Because we are conquering through him who loved us. Bottom line, as long as we wallow in the lie that God isn't for us, we stand defeated. And we will probably not escape very much difficulty that way anyway. I mean, everybody, sooner or later, faces very difficult things. And those who believe that God is for them have a whole lot more going for them than those who don't. It's one thing to be persecuted and even threatened with death or put to death when your fundamental understanding is God is for me in this, and if he is going to permit this, then I'm going to permit it because it's got to have something to do with something I'm not aware of, and I'm perfectly willing to trust that. So we can't go to the idea that being badly treated means we're defeated. We're only defeated if we wallow in the lie. He's not for you. If he was for you, you wouldn't be being treated like that. But Jesus didn't wallow in that. When he was delivered up, verse 32, he didn't say, no, I'm not going to do that, or God doesn't care about me, or whatever. And he wasn't defeated. It looked terrible. For 3 days, it looked horrible. It looked like he'd been defeated. Everybody thought he'd been defeated, but he didn't think that. As soon as he died, he was victorious, and he was the victor. And we are participants in that victory, which is far more than just a mere victory. It was an overwhelming flood. When Jesus died on Calvary, Satan was destroyed in terms of any future. His doom has been sealed by the cross, even if in history he is allowed to run free for a couple thousand or 3,000 or 4,000 years. His doom is sure. So, as we learn this truth, that he is for us, we cannot be separated from his love, we can actually begin to participate in the very same faith and attitude of love that he has. We can be conquerors through him who loves us. And that's why he can go on and say what he has to say in the last two verses of the text, but we're not going there tonight. We'll wind this paragraph up probably next time, unless I get caught up on one of those litany of lists. But after that, I assume that we'll go on into Romans 9 if that's what y'all want to do.